I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And a warning to our listeners, this segment will contain some graphic content about sexual assault in the military.
I was preyed upon and then raped by a superior officer.
Last week, Republican Senator Martha McSally from Arizona shared her story of assault before a Senate Armed Forces Subcommittee hearing on sexual assault in the military.
Unlike so many brave survivors, I didn't report being sexually assaulted. Like so many women and men, I didn't trust the system at the time. I blamed myself. I was ashamed and confused. And I thought I was strong, but felt powerless. The perpetrators abused their position of power in profound ways.
Senator McSally served for more than 20 years in the Air Force, and she was the first woman to fly in combat. But the experience of being sexually assaulted almost cut that career short.
I stayed silent for many years, but later in my career, as the military grappled with scandals and their wholly inadequate responses, I felt the need to let some people know I, too, was a survivor. I was horrified at how my attempt to share generally my experiences were handled. Like many victims, I felt the system was raping me all over again.
In 2017, reported cases of sexual assault in the military were on the rise. That's according to the Department of Defense, which received nearly 6,800 reports of sexual assault involving military members that year, up 10% from the previous year's numbers. It's something we need to talk about. We start today with a look at the culture of secrecy and fear of retaliation Senator McSally and many others say they've experienced when dealing with sexual assault in the military. And I have two people with me now to talk about the scope of sexual assault in the military today and what needs to happen next. Patricia Murphy is a justice and public health reporter from KUOW who's reported extensively on sexual assault in the military. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Tanzina.
And we're also joined by Lori Manning, a retired captain from the United States Navy and the director of government operations at the Service Women's Action Network. Thanks for joining us, Lori.
Hi, Tanzina and Patricia.
Lori, I want to get started with you. I mentioned at the top of the show we're seeing a 10% rise in reports of sexual assault in the military. What does that statistic actually tell us? Does it tell us that more sexual assaults are happening, or does it tell us that more people are reporting those assaults, or is it still unclear?
It's quite unclear, and it could be both those things. You know, the military hopes, as does everybody, that it means that more people are willing to come forth, but we just don't know.
And what was your reaction to Senator McSally's testimony, Lori?
Well, I was in the room, and it was a small room, so you could see her face quite clearly as she was talking. And I would say my own reaction was the same as everybody else's. Every jaw in that room dropped. Because if Senator McSally, who had a stellar Air Force career, couldn't muster the courage to think that the chain of command and the military would treat her fairly, there is none of us, not one of us, who could say, well, it would treat me fairly.
Patricia, can you help us understand Senator McSally's comments in the broader context of sexual assault in the military? We know this is not a new problem, but how long has it been an issue for the military?
Oh, for many, many years. And it's interesting, when I heard Senator McSally's testimony, I thought to myself, so many of the things about this testimony ring true for so many victims of sexual assault. She waited years to report. She chose not to report. She was retaliated against. She felt this within her career. Those things have always been true about victims of sexual assault, and especially within the military. It's still not a safe place to report this deeply personal event.
Lori, when sexual assault does occur in the military, what are the protocols there? Is there a protocol for responsibility to ensure that these claims are investigated adequately? Is there a protocol to prevent these things from happening?
Well, the protocols for what happens if it's reported are there. That's taken years to get in place. Now, if there's a report, it must be investigated. whether it's the initial report or it's the report of retaliation, which often happens to people who report it. But like many other things, there's a gap between what the protocol says and sometimes in some commands with what actually happens. The other problem is the military has been working on stopping sexual assault, at least since the Tailhook investigation back in the very early 90s. And as far as I can see, they haven't made any progress at all on the stopping of it.
Patricia, one of the things that happens often when we talk about sexual assault, particularly in the military or in a workplace, is that survivors are often forced to spend extended amounts of time with their abuser. What are the effects of that on a survivor?
Well, within the military, oftentimes, right, you're under contract to continue doing your job. So there are very few ways for you to fix that situation within your employment, you know, short of trying to get some kind of, you know, dismissal from the military, which doesn't help your career any. So oftentimes, you know, people are forced to go back into their jobs every day. Maybe that person is a superior officer. Maybe they're not. But the impact of that assault on your job and your ability to do your job impacts your entire unit. And that can have problems whether or not you've even said anything.
So, Lori, in her testimony, we heard Senator McSally say that she was, quote, horrified at how her attempt to share her experiences were handled. How similar is that experience to what other survivors of sexual assault in the military go through?
You know, similar to often what happens, particularly since it's often possible that it's your own boss who has done it to you or somebody else who's got a senior-junior relationship to you, somebody who's senior to you in the military and who you do have to see every day. And there's a lot of retaliation, and the military has done a terrible job at stopping that.
I want to talk also about what happens, like what should happen. And I want to play a clip from Senator McSally's testimony about who should really be in charge of oversight here. Let's take a listen.
We cannot command change from the outside alone. It must be deployed from within. It must be built and constantly maintained and expertly managed by commanders who are themselves educated, conditioned, and given the tools to ensure what you survived and what I survived happens to no warrior under their command. To that end, I very strongly believe that the commander must not be removed from the decision-making responsibility of preventing, detecting, and prosecuting military sexual assault.
Tell us a little bit about what Senator McSally means here in terms of oversight. There have been some debates about whether it should be outside of the military or inside, and McSally here is saying what?
What she's talking about is the Military Justice Improvement Act, which Senator Gillibrand of New York first introduced in Congress back in 2013 and which has still not passed. In the military, when there is a sexual assault, it's the accused's commanding officer who decides whether or not there will be a prosecution. Now, it used to be that he or she also decided whether it would even be investigated. That was changed by Congress about 5 years ago. It now has to be investigated. But it's still what they call general court-martial authority in the military, who's not a lawyer. These are not prosecutors. They're line officers. They might be an infantry person or a surface warfare or a submarine officer in the Navy with no legal training is making the decision on whether the case should be prosecuted. And I was surprised because I was there for Senator McSally's testimony, and everything she said beforehand led you to the conclusion that those commander should not be making that decision. And yet she sat there and said, but we should keep that authority within their purview.
To that point about who has oversight and who's paying attention here, one of the things that keeps getting lost, I think, a little bit in the conversation is what happens when people report. BuzzFeed just came out with a report that said that women in the military often have their medical concerns dismissed. I'm wondering, does that extend to issues of sexual assault, Patricia?
Well, you know, I have heard this anecdotally from women who have reported their sexual assault that their emotional needs were not taken care of, their physical needs, you know, depending on how violent that assault was, may have been treated, you know, on the outset. But yeah, down the line, a woman's pain, a woman's perception of pain is discounted. I've heard this across the board for all kinds of health issues and not just sexual assault. And that's something that extends to women too. You know, they have, as a member of the military in a male-dominated field, you have this, you know, you want to suck it up. You don't want to be that person. So that's ingrained in you as a woman participating in a male-dominated military. You know, I think there are individuals within this system who are trying to do good work, but overall they're working in what is really an untenable system for victims of sexual assault.
Well, and the other thing that's interesting as we're talking about this, and Laura, you mentioned this early in the conversation, was, you know, some of the earlier examples we've heard about sexual assault in the military. It's 2019. What do we need to see happen so that we can prevent this from happening in the future?
The military culture needs a complete overhaul, as does the U.S. culture that surrounds it. You know, I've been following all the Me Too stuff, and it seems to me some of the perpetrators have very strange ideas of what consent is. And I think we need to do a much better job raising kids right from the beginning to understand that sort of stuff. And we've got to stop the sexism. We've got to stop allowing people to get away with sexism, because the sexism is what causes disrespect of women, and that can lead to sexual assault. We've got to teach respect and the dignity of other people.
And Patricia, what about you? Are you watching anything at a policy level that you think could help prevent sexual assault going forward?
I think that Lori's point is absolutely accurate and spot on. I think the thing that we're not talking about in this conversation is the role that alcohol plays in a lot of sexual assaults. A majority of the military, a good portion of the military, are young people under 25. This is an exciting time for them sexually. This is an exciting time for them in terms of their growth. Their life is, you know, challenging in the military, and it's extreme. When they go out and they decompress, alcohol is present a lot of the time, and that can have a significant impact on decision making and how assaults take place.
Patricia Murphy is a justice and public health reporter from KUOW, and Lori Manning is a retired captain from the United States Navy and the director of government operations at the Service Women's Action Network. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Almost 2% of high school students said they identify as transgender. That's according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Among those students who identify as transgender, few play high school sports. And when they do, they face obstacles, from being forced to compete with the gender they don't identify with to questions of fairness when they do. These issues played out recently in South Dakota. Last month, the legislature narrowly defeated a bill that would have forced high school athletes to play sports with the gender they were assigned at birth. It's an issue that's been taking hold in states across the country. Katie Barnes is a writer and reporter for ESPNW, and they told me there's no federal policy that covers high school athletes who are transgender.
Each state has its own policies, and there are 17 states, including the District of Columbia, that have policies that lean towards transgender inclusion, so do not require any level of legal or medical intervention. There's about 20 states that have some sort of case-by-case basis or a hormone wait period for transgender girls or some combination thereof. There are 5 states that do not have any policy at all, and then there are 9 states that have restrictive policies, meaning that they require either some sort of medical intervention in the form of surgery or some sort of legal intervention in the terms of changing a birth certificate or something like that.
So let's take a look again at 2 cases that were big in the news. There were, and these are 2 stories that you actually followed. One was a trans boy in Texas who was forced to wrestle with girls. What happened in that experience?
It was a confluence of issues that was really unique to Texas in many ways. So Texas is one of only 6 states at the time, and now 7 states, that actually has a separate sanctioned event for girls wrestling. Many states, the majority of the states in the country, have just wrestling. And then in February of 2016, a policy was put on the ballot for the superintendents in the state to vote on that would basically codify a policy that would establish gender as being determined by birth certificate. And so what that means is that if you are 14, 15 years old, whatever the sex is that's on your birth certificate determines what sport you play in. And so for Mac Beggs, who identifies as a boy, was assigned female at birth and had begun a medical transition because of Texas rules and policies, was forced to wrestle in the girls category.
What is that experience like for a trans boy?
It's really challenging. You know, constantly you are either assumed to be a part of that gender or you feel differently. And so there's just not that affirmation of being able to compete with and against people who identify the same way that you do and have that gender and sense of self consistently affirmed on a regular basis.
And Katie, I'm wondering if you could help me understand the bigger goal here. Would the goal be, because I think what's interesting is you mentioned that some states, for example, with wrestling, there's single-sex wrestling, male girls and boys, and in other states, that's not the case. Is the goal ultimately to have sports in school that are not defined by any gender whatsoever, where boys, girls, or however someone identifies does not impact what type of team they're allowed to play on?
I think those are two separate issues. There's one that's about inclusion in terms of how we delineate what teams people play on. Mm-hmm. And then there's another question about the nature of sport itself. And sport is designed to be a binary. We have boys and we have girls, we have men's, we have women's. And increasingly, culturally, we're not understanding gender to be a binary. And we also know that biological sex is not a binary. Both of those things are spectrums. And so we are seeing an increasing number of students who are identifying as transgender younger. The CDC released a report last month that said that about 1.7% of teenagers were identifying as trans. And that includes binary transgender identities, meaning transgender boys and transgender girls, but also non-binary identities and gender non-conforming identities. And how we include those kids in sport is an open question. And so I don't think it's my place to say whether the right way to go is to get rid of sex categories completely for sport. I don't really believe in that. I write about women's sports almost exclusively, and I really enjoy that work and believe very strongly in that work. But I do think that we are coming, you know, up on a time when we're going to have to re-examine the system that has been created and who it was created for, and if there is a better system that's more inclusive for all kids, and what that looks like at, you know, the youth level, the high school level, the college level, and the elite level. Those are all things that I think are going to have to be sorted out in the coming decades.
And there was another story in the news, a trans girl named Andrea, who's a runner in Connecticut, and she runs with other girls. What made that so newsworthy?
Well, she won. That's what made it newsworthy. Andrea, as a freshman, won the state championship in her class in the 100 meter and the 200 meter in outdoor. And then again in that same class as for the 55 meter and indoor during her sophomore season. And then, of course, another transgender girl also came out and started to run in Connecticut and began winning championships. And so together, the two of them have really been in the spotlight in both positive and negative ways.
And when you say that the negative ways they have been in the spotlight, is it because people think there's some sort of unfair advantage that they have? Like, what's the backlash about?
Undoubtedly. People mm-hmm. think that they have an unfair advantage. Connecticut is one of those states that does not require any sort of medical or legal intervention for transgender kids to participate with the gender that they want to. And so there are folks that say, well, because, you know, they're making assumptions about these kids' medical status, but they say that because they haven't gone through medical intervention or any kind of hormone therapy, there's an unfair advantage and they are, quote unquote, still biological men. And there's a lot of problems with that rhetoric in general, but that has been largely what the two of them have been facing every time they win a championship. And it's certainly been very tough on the two of them. I speak with Andrea every once in a while, and, you know, I know that there's been an uptick in just sort of kind of hate mail to the Athletic Association, surely, that each of those kids are facing that as well since their names are in the press. Mm. And so that really seems to be what the uproar is.
And also another interesting detail here is that LGBT youth and particularly trans youth are less likely just generally to participate in sports. Why is that?
Well, sport is a site of pain and trauma for a number of LGBTQ people. It's not a place that has historically been friendly to people who identify as LGBTQ, especially transgender folks. for a number of reasons, including what I said earlier about the system designed to be a binary. And if you don't fit that binary, that can feel very exclusive. And so there are already all of these barriers, both cultural and from a policy perspective, put in place that make it very challenging for LGBTQ people to participate. And so their participation numbers are already really low. And then when trans youth in particular are successful, they're often demonized very publicly. And that happened with Mac Beggs. It has happened with Andrea Yearwood and Terry Miller. And for the next person who is successful, that will also probably happen with them as well. I've never seen a situation where a transgender kid who's in high school wins a championship or is athletically successful being met with positive applause. Mm. There's almost always a dark side to that, if not a predominantly negative side to that for those kids. And it's because they are often derided as being cheaters or as having an unfair advantage. And it's really tough. And so every time that happens publicly, another kid who identifies similarly may think twice about whether or not they want to come out or whether or not they want to even play sports to begin with.
Katie, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Katie Barnes is a writer and reporter for ESPNW. They're also an executive producer on Mac Wrestles, a documentary that premiered over the weekend at South by Southwest about Mac Beggs, a transgender high school wrestler in Texas. And now we're asking our transgender listeners, did you play sports in high school? And if so, what was your experience like?
Hi, my name is Cage. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I'm a queer trans man. And so when I was a kid, I was picked on and bullied and teased mercilessly for not fitting into what all the other girls looked like. And sports was where I found my refuge. It was where I could run out all my frustration and all my anger and find my identity. And it was really what saved me. Now I'm a coach, and I think there should be far more opportunities for kids to explore and express their gender as athletes and not be pinned in by the very strict binary of male and female expectations in sports.
This is Silas. I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. I'm a 25-year-old trans man. I only started my medical transitions about 7 months ago, so I've lived much of my life as the sex that was assigned to me at birth. I was a high school athlete and played several sports for a Christian school that is a part of the KCAA, which is the Kentucky Christian Athletic Association. Due to the fact that I grew up in a highly religious household, I was not permitted to express my true gender. Playing sports was never an issue for me because I never ruffled any feathers by trying to present as male or play on any male teams. I always wanted to play with the other boys, and I feel like I was deprived of an opportunity which I had a right to pursue. I hope that trans kids in the future are given a choice as to which sports teams they play on. Nobody should ever be forced into a role which they do not fit.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. In an executive order last Wednesday, President Trump rolled back an Obama-era policy that set guidelines for how the U.S. reports the number of people killed in drone strikes outside of designated combat zones. The rule change has transparency advocates worried, particularly over how it could limit access to data on civilian death tolls. Jeremy Scahill is a co-founder and investigative reporter for The Intercept. Thanks for being with us, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Complicated issue. Let's talk about what Trump's executive order is meant to do.
Well, at the end of the Obama administration, Obama, constitutional law scholar, was concerned about if Trump wins, the trust me, I'm a lawyer,
I'm
I know
a
what
guy.
I'm doing,
yeah.
Which is how he got a lot of liberals to support drone strikes. He started saying, oh my God, what if Hillary doesn't win? So they quickly put together a set of rules that ACLU and other civil liberties groups and journalists have been pushing for, be more transparent. So what Trump is doing is basically just saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to maintain the secrecy. And, you know, a lot of this is coming from people within his neocon wing of the administration who are basically saying Congress has no business knowing anything unless we decide to tell them, because under Article 2 of the Constitution, Commander-in-Chief is essentially a dictator when it comes to national security policy.
That's a pretty intense statement there.
Well, this is the theory of the unitary executive. conservative. And the fact that Trump now has William Barr as his attorney general is part of, I think, why you're seeing this happen right now. I think Barr probably came on board and with the national security stuff signed off on a bunch of things that had been being debated. And because of the netherworld with Jeff Sessions didn't happen. But let's remember, Obama was no grand hero of transparency on this issue. I mean, he authorized the killing, including of American citizens who hadn't even been charged with crimes. So what we're seeing under Trump, yes, it's rolling back the clock a bit, but we didn't have any great shakes under Obama. From the beginning, this whole thing has been shrouded in secrecy, and Trump is just sort of doubling down on that a bit more than Obama did.
So I want to go back to, I want to follow up on this Obama policy with drones. A producer at The Takeaway here talked to Ned Price, who is a spokesman for the National Security Council under Obama, and he said that the Obama administration's decision in 2016 to start disclosing drone strike data from non-combat zones was less about transparency and more of a strategic decision. Let's take a listen.
Strategic in the sense that for the first time, it allowed the administration to rebut with actual facts and figures the misinformation and even disinformation that terrorist groups and other adversaries around the globe put out in an attempt to undermine public confidence in and perception of the effectiveness and the accuracy and the results of American drone strikes, of our counterterrorism operations around the world.
What is he saying, Jeremy?
Well, he's saying basically when we do a drone strike and we kill a bunch of terrorists, Al-Qaeda will say, oh, you also killed 20 civilians. I understand the logic of what Ned's saying. I think it's based on a bit of fallacy, though, because the fact is that when the CIA kills people in drone strikes or the military, unless a journalist or a human rights organization posthumously proves they were a civilian, the policy of the Democrats, Republicans, U.S. government is that they are enemies killed in action. So if 10 people are killed in a drone strike and the one bad guy you said was the target is killed, until those other identities are confirmed or known, the presumption of the U.S. government is that they were enemies killed in action. So Ned is sort of playing around with, I mean, he's not saying something counterfactual, but he's playing around with what's actually important in this. If you want to stop, and I know this from my time on the ground in these undeclared war zones, Yemen, Somalia, elsewhere, if you want to stop terrorist recruiting and the propaganda is your issue, don't kill civilians. That's the real issue.
Jeremy, as I mentioned, we spoke to Ned Price, and he walked us through a little bit of the Obama administration's decision-making process on drone strikes.
He made clear that we had to determine, first and foremost, that other options, including capture, weren't feasible, that we had to determine that there was near certainty that non-combatants wouldn't be injured in any such operation, and that targeted terrorists would be present.
How different or accurate is that compared to what Trump is trying to do?
Well, first of all, I can point to several specific cases where that wasn't true, where, in fact, a 16-year-old American citizen was killed and they claim he was not the target of the strike, where U.S. persons that were being held prisoner or European people that were being held prisoner were killed in drone strikes, where the United States could have captured Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen, but the Obama administration decided that he was so dangerous he needed to die. So there's a little bit of playing with the facts there, but there's no comparison to Trump. I mean, Trump has openly said he wants to fill up Guantanamo, torture more people, kill the families of terrorists. Yes, there's a cosmetic difference, but we see the proof is in the killing. And Trump is killing a tremendous number of people with drones and with the boots on the ground military. So you have all the worst parts of Obama plus the lies, the cover-ups, and not even pretending to be about accountability.
You've also talked about a turf war between the CIA and the Pentagon when it comes to drone strikes in particular. Tell us what that means, and how does that affect what we're talking about today?
This goes back to 9/11, when Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney viewed the CIA as a kind of liberal discussion group, and so they tried to siphon away a lot of the authority of the CIA and put it in the hands of special operations forces. Under Obama, a lot of that ended up getting resolved. There still are some outstanding conflicts between CIA and the military over who controls what battlefield, but it does seem under Trump and with the ascent of Gina Haspel, a longtime CIA officer, who may have been involved in torture, that has largely been bridged under Trump, in part because this is not a commander-in-chief who is in on the minutiae. Obama was poring over these reports. Trump's like, give me the pictures, bullet points, and make sure my name is mentioned if you want the policy to go through. So It's a lot scarier than it was under Obama, even if the net effect is of the same family, a lot of people being killed and we don't know their identities.
Jeremy, we were just going into sort of President Obama's approach on this. How does, first of all, I want to be clear, is this less data or no data that the Trump administration is advocating for?
Well, we've already seen that the Trump administration, when something goes right or they think that they've done some spectacular military operation, they want the entire world to know. Remember when Trump celebrated his dropping of the Moab, the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan? I mean, it was like the second coming of, you know, of the atomic bombing of Japan in terms of the technological significance to Trump. I think it's dirtier data is the way we could look at it, where it's going to be even more selectively presented to the public than occurred under Obama. And, you know, look, there has been a serious ratcheting up of drone strikes on the part of the Trump administration. Everyone's talking about Trump, Russia, the 2020 race. This guy has doubled down on the worst excesses of Bush and Obama. He has lifted restrictions on killing civilians. In Somalia alone, Trump now has done 20-something drone strikes in this year alone, and he has loosened the rules. Obama wanted to do so-called leadership strikes, where they're taking out known people with a track record in terrorist activity.
And yet he still had civilian casualties.
Oh, he had a lot of civilian casualties. But I'm talking about the stated policy was we are going after the leadership. Trump's not even pretending that anymore. If you are some kid who's getting paid a little bit of money in Somalia or Yemen to basically guard some post somewhere, they're going to treat you in the same way that they would treat Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda. You are a legitimate target. The metrics of that are very complicated. And I do think that there is a direct connection between an increase in support for terrorist organizations and an increase in drone strikes, particularly those that are killing civilians. We saw that under Obama with AQAP in Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I think we're going to see it in a lot more places under Trump. This is a dangerous administration in terms of the capability they have militarily and with the CIA, and lying and lack of accountability. Even the minimal accountability standards that Obama put in place in the 11th hour, they've said, no, we're not going to participate in that. This is a very dangerous situation. And I think a lot of us have been making a mistake by paying not enough attention to Trump's war policies. It's bad.
Well, let's also talk about how drone warfare has evolved since President Obama. I mean, this was one of the first times, I think, under his presidency that we'd actually begun to understand how the military was using this. What makes you so concerned? Is it worse technology? Is it better technology now? Is it going to be more efficient? Where do we stand today with drone warfare?
Obama really embraced drones not out of any love for the technology. It was because he didn't want to do large-scale troop deployments, and he spent a lot of his political credibility on a national security level convincing liberals that this is a smarter way to wage war. What we've seen, though, over the past 10 years is that a lot of civilians are killed in drone strikes, maybe not as many as would be killed in conventional Tomahawk cruise missile strikes or ground invasions. But the question is always framed as, should we do drone strikes or troops on the ground, when we should be saying, what does our engagement with the entire Muslim world look like? What is an actual sane approach to countering national security
or
terrorist threats?
You're talking diplomacy, right?
I mean, well, diplomacy, working with regional partners, and not being afraid to negotiate with governments that say, yeah, we are Islamic in nature, but we pose no threat to the Western world. History is rife with stories where the United States intervenes in countries because they're concerned about Islamic fundamentalism and end up overthrowing the very people that would have been the best counter to terrorism. Bush overthrew a government in Somalia in 2006. No one ever talks about it. Called the Islamic Courts Union. They were the best counter to al-Shabaab, now, the terrorist group now. There's not a lot of thinking ahead on either party's part in this country.
What happened? You said the data is going to get dirtier. Where do people go to find good information, accurate information, cleaner data about what's happening on the ground, if anywhere?
The UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism and the New America Foundation in the United States both have been tracking drone strikes for a very long time. I would say that the Bureau for Investigative Journalism has a very proven track record, and they're very conservative in their methodology, excuse me. It is out there, but can we trust the source that it's coming from? Under Obama at the end, yeah, they pretty much were straight shooting. Under Trump, who knows? I mean, is he going to start tweeting about this stuff and that's how we'll find out about it? And is it true? Probably not. It's bad. It's really bad.
Jeremy Scahill is a co-founder and investigative reporter at The Intercept. Thanks for joining us, Jeremy.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, that's all for us today. But thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to The Takeaway. We say it a lot, but we really mean it. Our listeners are the most important part of our show. We want to hear from you. Jump into the discussion on our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. And keep listening. Thanks again.